Of the House Committee on Environment and Land Use, it is 8:35. So we have one change on our agenda, and that is that House Bill 2337 will not be heard in this committee. It's gone to a similar bill has gone to another committee, which has already heard the bill. So 2337 will not be heard. We will start this morning by opening the public meeting on House Bill 2137. This is our conclusion of the public hearing on this bill, and it is invited guests. And we'll start off, if Buzz Ortiz is here this morning, we'll start off with Buzz. Okay. We'll start the informational meeting in that regard, and good morning, Mr. Ortiz.
Good morning, sir. My name is Baltazar Ortiz. Most people know me as Buzz Ortiz. And what I'd like to do is to kind of give you a little bit of my background on myself and what I do, and then go into how the implementation of certain ordinances have impacted not only what I do, but valuation of properties and the impact on what I try to do in the community. I've been in the construction industry since the early 60s. Having been involved in the construction of many of the freeways in the state of Oregon, the state of Washington, forming my own company, construction company, in the early 70s, 1976. We have built many of the infrastructure in the state of Oregon, developed many subdivisions in the greater Portland area. The last 10, 12 years of my life have been involved in creating affordable housing for people of lower incomes. I happen to live in the city of Sandy. My family owns approximately 45 acres of land inside the city limits. The zoning on the property that we own is high residential, high density, 22 acres of that. 22 acres of that is single family residential. As you probably are aware, the zoning is the driving factor behind the density that's allowed on a piece of property. Single residential basically means 2 to 6 units per acre. High density designation of an R3 is 10, minimum of 10 to a maximum of 20 units per acre. How the ordinances that are in place in the city of Sandy impact our properties is that they wind up reducing the density that's allowable in these properties. By the ordinances that are in place, they restrict what you can do with the property. For example, Sandy, prior to Measure 7, had a restriction that you could not build within 150 feet of the high water mark of a fish-bearing stream. It had a restriction and it says that you could not build on slopes that are in excess of 25% grade. It had a further restriction that said that slopes that were between 15 and 24.9% of grade, you would lose half the density of the allowable density on a property. But they also have a restriction that says that if you cannot meet the minimum density, you cannot build on the property. So you basically are boxed in many different directions. First of all, you have to give up 150 feet of property that's within the high water mark. That's not necessarily where the stream is running. That's usually a 100-year floodplain. So you wind up giving up 150 feet of property that at that point did not allow any building of any type. Currently, since Measure 7 has come about, they are revising the ordinances that are in place that fall under what they call the FISH ordinance. FISH ordinance is an acronym for flood slope hazard. The city of Sandy actually sits on a knoll where floods really don't impact the city of Sandy. Slopes, yes, slopes. The city sits on a knoll where there are slopes because of the terrain. Hazard, basically, they talking about slide areas, potential slide areas. What we have 22 acres that we have tried to build a subdivision on this high density parcel. We were denied the application because of the slopes, because of the wetlands that claim to be on the site. We're still taxed for high density. There was a gentleman that spoke earlier about the ability to be able to take this case to the next level to the appeal. And it would cost several hundred dollars if you went to an attorney and had an attorney represent you. The truth of the matter is my family has spent over $185,000 in attorney fees to try and develop this land for affordable housing. We have received a judgment against us for additional $119,000 for attorney fees from the city. So actually we have over $250,000 in attorney fees and liens against us simply because we have tried to develop a piece of property that the ordinances that are in place prohibit us from developing to the full potential of this property. The truth of the matter is that a lot of times the cities will use or communities will use ordinances to try and keep certain types of developments out of a community. My background is from the last 10 years is to try and develop affordable housing for people of lower incomes. This project has been projected as one that would bring in to the community people of lower incomes. I am the founder of probably the largest Hispanic community development corporation in the state of Oregon, which just this past year was the recipient of the Developer of the Year award from 1,000 Friends of Oregon. The new revised FISH that's going into place is going to allow us to bring another application before the city because they have lessened the restrictions because of the potential passage of Measure 7. And even though it is now no longer a factor, this community is trying to change the ordinances in place to allow potential development on properties that before were not allowed. The community, through the planning department, planning division, is charged with looking at the ordinances and the development codes and making sure that they adhere to what the development code is and the ordinances that are in places. But a lot of times, communities were influenced by public opinion that a particular project should not go in, even though it is sown and it has outright permitted usage. of that property. When the public comes to these meetings and voices opposition many times, the Planning Commission will look at these ordinances as the way to restrict or possibly not make the project feasible. I would like to voice my support, obviously, in House Bill 2137, because I think that there's a lot of communities that use ordinances and development codes to prohibit the development of certain types of housing. If property owners like myself wind up losing the value of this property, this particular property, if we were to be able to develop to the full potential, would have a value in anywhere between $1.2 million to $2.8 million, using a $6,000 per door value for the property. And yet, I've already spent over $250,000 trying to develop this piece of property under the development codes, and we continue to face opposition. That's all I had to say. I'd be more than glad to answer any questions.
Any questions of Mr. Ortiz?
Sir.
Representative Greenland.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Ortiz, I sort of like to understand the situation.
Sure.
When, with the ordinance that you're concerned about, the 150-foot setback and the 25% slope and, mm-hmm. and those issues, were okay. were they in place at the time you bought the property?
No.
Follow-up, sir.
Follow-up.
After you bought the property, they put those in place. Were they put in place as a result of the where they thought they were going on the particular new land use goals on riparian setbacks and things like that, or do you think they were specifically aimed at your use?
I don't know whether it was specifically for my use. The metro area at the time had a 30-foot setback for riparian setbacks.
Well, just one more brief
follow.
Because I remember there was the brief discussion of making 200-foot setbacks
right.
in order to meet the goal, and I was wondering if that was all a part of that issue, which they've now backed off of, as I understand.
It all came back from NIMS, the endangered fish potential regulations that came about, a 200-foot setback. At this time, we're talking about a 70-foot setback with allowance of half the density that you would lose with the new fish ordinance that would be in place. Now, with the new ordinance that's being has been approved, now you can build on any slope, providing that you have a scientific study that shows that you that land would support what you're building. So Measure 7 has brought about some realistic building codes, simply because the communities are now concerned that they might be having to compensate people for property. I don't have a problem with people if the community wants to save property for the future, if they're willing to pay for it, you know, a fair price. A fair market price. Absolutely. I think that would be the right thing to do. My interest is to try and create affordable housing. I happen to sit on as vice chair of the Oregon Housing Council, and we see this throughout the state. You know, it's not just Sandy. It's throughout the state. The restrictions that are placed on properties sometimes, not always, but sometimes, have to do with the type of housing that's going to go in.
Any further questions, Representative Zell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Buzz, could you live with the setback if you were able to develop the rest of the property the way you wanted to in the high density, or is it not possible?
No, it's absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, I can see that the city wants to maintain a buffer between the stream. I absolutely am in agreement, and I totally support the transfer of density, you know, the transfer of that density that you lose to the other property. I mean, that's an equitable way of doing it, even though in this case they're only transferring half the density.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
You mentioned they changed the rules. How long ago did they change those?
They were implemented this past December.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions of Mr. Ortiz? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony, Mr. Thank Ortiz. Us. Ralph Gruner.
Gruner.
We were going to officially apologize for the misspelling of your name.
He's been called a lot of things. So
do we vote on that?
Let me apologize.
I don't know if Mr. Gruner would like us to vote on him. You might not pass, Ralph.
I don't have a name.
I know. It's really bad. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and wonderful members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Gruner. I represent AskMe. Just a few comments that, similar to the chair, I served as a county commissioner, and I'm sitting here listening to these stories. I lived with that for 8 years, one of the reasons I left. Wasn't the love of my life, rural land use planning. Matter of fact, I did leave because I don't like it, so I'm not going to deal with land use, other than to say, Mr. Chair, as you probably found out, I was willing to stand up for people if they were being treated unfairly. That oftentimes put me at odds end with my fellow commissioners, staff, and the public. That's all I'm going to say about it. I had occasions where sometimes I'd have a garage built with an inch off, and they were told, you will move that garage. And I just want you to know, I think I'm older than most here, other than Cliff, probably, and... I don't mean it. We're about the same era. Country music, kind of way back. Kind of.
Representative Zahner is open to all kinds of comments.
We'll leave that alone.
Thank the witness on my behalf.
My only comment then is, on a land use side, I've been through it, but I don't want to, if somebody, to me, in the world of land use, it's balance. I used to listen to one side, and then I'd listen to the other side, and I learned I haven't heard all the facts. I'm older now, and I realize that everything I hear from one side isn't always necessarily, although they mean 100% to be honest and truthful, all the facts are in. I learned later in life that I needed that. So it's about balance, fairness to the individual. But I want to comment on something that, although the cities and counties testified, I really deal with revenue. Probably one of three or four people in the building that have 30 years of revenue experience, having lived with this system in Salem all my life, it seems like. My concern has to do with, and I realize the quotes coming out are that we're not going to deal with costing the public, and if that's, we're going to get it a fair, I don't know what happened, by the way, Mr. Chair, when I was county commissioner, 76 through 85.
Was that was that 19?
Yes, sir. Okay. 90, yes. Prehistoric era. We used to be able to give at the local level non-farm uses, etc., if in fact somebody, and we would go visit. Not only visit, the commissioners would visit with staff, and we put a lot of time into that and thought into it, and so we were able to come back and deal with the kinds of appeals and so forth, but we personally did that, at least in Clackamas County. Something's changed in my life, evidently, since I've been gone, and I don't know what it is, so therefore I won't comment on it, and I'm going to stick to economics. I made a quote on the floor of the House in 73 that if we didn't get seniors off property tax, we'd rue the day in this state. And if I sound serious, because my quote was dealing with the McCall tax plan, Tom was our governor, and I was chair of his speaker's bureau at the time statewide on the McCall tax plan. Looking back, we both were wrong. because it would have been, and I admit that, we would have increased the dependence on the income tax, gotten rid of, if you recall, some don't, the property tax. And that would have been a mistake looking at our system now, but we were looking for a progressive system to replace, basically was coming from seniors on fixed incomes. But as I look at what we're trying to do in Oregon in Measure 7 and all of the measures in land use that we deal with, I realize, hold it. Measure 5, which you're well aware of, really took, and I wanted to know the exact statistic, and it's well over $1 billion a year, and I know if you're of some bent, you'll say that, well, that's good because it's now in the public's pocket, but the way I view it is that's fine, and I don't mind that the public voted for Measure 5, by the way, because we were fifth highest in the nation, and we rued the day, and we beat it down, and I was chairman statewide of the opposition twice. And fact is, we deserved to lose. We didn't do anything about it. And the result was, we have a Measure 5 that now costs the state in new cost, the 25-75 reversal, is about $3.47 billion, and I'll call that $3.5 billion. And at the same time, we passed Measure 47-50, or 50, in this state in 1997, and I went and I asked, what is that costing in property tax revenue per year? The 3.7 was passed on by Measure 5 to the state, to the income tax. By the way, Measure 5 costs the property tax over $1 billion per year, as well as the $3.5 billion out of the general fund in income tax. And I don't want to get into that here. That's for Revenue Committee. But the fact is, we also had 47-50 that I'm now told by the experts cost us another $1 billion off the property tax roll. And I'm looking at $2 billion a year off the rolls that cities, counties, and special districts really could depend on pre-1990. And I don't really think that the public did this intentionally, but now we're looking at a system, so I want to be very careful, very broad-minded about it, and fair in talking about the impact on the economy, because let me give you an example. If we begin hitting, as we did pre-1990, our assessors, as an example, the layoffs, and our assessors can't keep the appraisals up to date, the fact of the matter is that more adversely affects our schools, who won't adequately get the latest construction on the rolls, etc. And that happened. That's why we changed some things in Oregon that we did, because we had that crisis. So the only thing I'm concerned about is that if we're looking at removing what is the general fund for local government, which is, as you know, is property tax, and we further remove on top of the $2 billion that's already been removed from local government over the last decade, then I believe that Oregon needs to talk about, what is that going to mean to educate? We already know what it means to education. What does that mean to our economic development efforts in this state? And at the heart of it, to me, is we can't continue to take away dollars from the local level. On the other hand, they need to be fair. No. Or you better believe it. On how they deal with people and their lives. I'm a very compassionate and a passionate person, and I can go one way. As far as I'm concerned, you treat people fairly, and you treat people decently. And that's what it's so hard at being a public servant at that level. Even if it gets you in trouble with some folks, it's not worth the salary they pay anyway to worry about it in the first place. So where I'm coming from is that I realize you're talking about not further exacerbating the local government financial system. We have no property tax in the general fund. By the way, 40% in our latest poll of the public believe property taxes in our general fund. That's the local government. It used to be until 1930 when we finally got the income tax passed. So
it's one of the big misconceptions that people don't understand, that the state doesn't get any of that money. It all goes to local government.
40%.
Correct.
Believe that. So I just am here not, if I hadn't said anything, I'd feel guilty. I like you folks, and I wanted to be able to talk to you, and I'm concerned with economic impact, local government as well as schools. I'm talking about K-12, but also community colleges, and our services. We've gone to awfully high fees in Oregon in the last decade, as you know, at our local level, because if we were going to continue building codes, planning, et cetera, we had to say you're going to pay it. You're going to have to pay it because we no longer have the money in the general fund. So local government's been fighting that, and so I would be very cautious that we don't turn Oregon, we don't make this even more adverse financially and fiscally at the local level, because that will impact our economic development effort. So that's all I want to say. And I appreciate your niceness to me and the way you've dealt with me.
Any questions for Mr. Groner? Representative Zauner?
Yes, Mr. Groner. Hey, Ralph, seriously, it seems a lot of people testifying had permitting problems, how they get through the permit system, and with your great vast knowledge of working for the counties, can we simplify that for them somehow? Can we sit down in our work group, because that's going to be part of my work group, and try to help them get through the process and maybe not have to cost so much money and go from one to the other to the other?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zauner, you accidentally asked the right person. I serve on what's called the group, which is looking at the permitting process. That's business, labor, cities, counties. The group is about 25 folks. We will be coming to you through state building codes, et cetera, with some streamlining. We had a model that you all passed a few years ago in the Tri-County area that got made the permitting process easier, more accessible. And consistency is a big word we hear statewide. Be consistent where you're at as well as here. So we are working on that. We realize there are some problems in areas, and we want to make sure that that's alleviated so that people who are going in for that process know that what they're hearing here is the same kind of thing here. But you'll always have interpretations at the local level. Could I give you an example of that? In minor permitting for minor electrical, et cetera, now in the Tri-County area, and we're ready to bring all that statewide, you no longer have to go. You can pick up your bundle of those, your little coupon book, and you can take that from Sandy, since it's Tri-County, all the way out on the other side of Tri-County to Hillsborough and use that permit. Where we're heading in Oregon is try to get that consistency so that, in fact, there are certain things that you can do in that. And the other is to accelerate our industrial, that's your issue, I said, land base. And an example of that where a group of us are working on it is that some of us believe this rankles some inside the bureaucracy. This is at the local level. You won't mind this at all. What we really need to do is have one person. There are several divisions. There'll be 7, 8 divisions that a permitting process has to go through. And if you're talking a company wants to come in, then we need to assign one person to cubbyhole that and stay with it and not do the plan review at the end, but rather let the plan review develop consistent with when the permitting's been approved, and that one person has the authority. We're currently working on this, and yes, there's a lot of effort going into that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ralph.
Any other questions of Mr. Groner? Representative Ashman.
Just a statement. I want to thank Mr. Groner for, again, coming before us, and I think in trying to enlighten us as we get into another area of so-called unfunded mandates. I think your message to me has always been loud and clear. I don't think it's been loud and clear to maybe other legislators that continue to want to fund initiate programs and not provide for the appropriate funding. I think your thesis is well taken. If previous legislatures had the political will to fund programs, we would not be out of bounds today. We would have to be worried about Measure 28. I thank you for your position on that, because I think it's one that should be pressed and continually heard throughout this assembly.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony this morning. Brad Witt. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Brad Witt, Secretary-Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and there are 180,000 working men and women who comprise our organization across our state. I am appearing this morning in opposition to House Bill 2137 as it is currently written. The 10% threshold in the bill seems likely to invite litigation, which is, from our vantage point, not a desirable outcome. Litigation itself may be problematic. I personally believe that litigation tends to breed more litigation, and again, personally feel that our society today is perhaps far too litigious. Defending against the litigation may become financially burdensome for the various governments that may be cited under the bill, as would possibly the potential financial settlements or foregone revenue opportunities that might occur as a result of those legal settlements. The bill provides downsides for taxpayers when they must pay compensation to landowners or make up the difference in lost revenues that are provided on the bill. And while it does this, it does not provide upside in those instances when government regulations may actually enhance the value of real private property. It also appears that House Bill 2137 fails to make a distinction between voluntary and involuntary land use restrictions. This loophole could lead to unintended and undesirable outcomes. For instance, the bill might invite speculation in properties that contain significant wetlands, and it could then become lucrative for speculators to enter their wetlands into riparian set-aside agreements, possibly, say, with the state of Oregon. Now, under this scenario, the incentive for entering into such voluntary set-asides is House Bill 2137's 10% takings threshold. This relatively low 10% may well serve as a speculative target to be met for the purpose of subsidizing land purchases at taxpayers' expense. Even worse, to the extent that House Bill 2137 becomes an attractive vehicle for speculative land acquisitions, it might also encourage subdividing and property line adjustments and similar rearrangements of land, with the sole intent of meeting the 10% takings threshold. And it is difficult for folks like myself to imagine such types of property divisions serving the interests of anyone other than the speculators, which is not necessarily a public purpose. This would constitute a mockery, albeit an unintended one, of our state's land use planning efforts. And lastly, the bill appears to eliminate much of land use planning as it now exists. And I feel that it would tend to make a whole lot of regulators in that arena very gun-shy, and I have deep concerns about what that would do in terms of enforcement. And so for those reasons, Mr. Chairman, I urge some changes to the bill, and would be happy to attempt to answer any questions that your committee might have.
Any questions of Mr. Witt? You're off easy, Brad.
So far,
I'm sorry, Representative Ackerman.
Lower the arms.
Mr. Witt, you had mentioned briefly that there may be cases in which land use regulations could enhance the value of property. This is a proposition I will continue to advance because I think that's fundamentally correct. Do you have any examples that you could give us what you mean by that statement, just for the record?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, I could, I guess, use my own personal case as an example. I own 35 acres as a small farm in rural Columbia County, and I have found that my property values in the last decade have increased substantially, as have most all of them. But I do believe that in part, at least, that increase is due to a relatively open space. As more and more land is developed, there's less and less relatively larger parcels that are open, and as a consequence, those parcels are becoming more and more desirable by a number of folks. So I think that's one issue. Perhaps another one, again in my own personal instance, I have substantial potential for mineral development on my property. I have been told, at least by the geologist that did soundings, that I have a very large natural gas reservoir under my property, and it is appealing to companies that would potentially be interested in developing that gas sometime in the future to only have to deal with one person, myself, as opposed to having to deal with a number of landowners on a given piece of property. So again, I think the fact that my property is restricted rural farm and forestry has led to an increase in the desirability and hence the value of my property.
Any other questions of Mr. Witt? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That concludes the informational portion of our meeting on House Bill 2137, and we are closing the public hearing on House Bill 2137. After 2 weeks and over 10 hours of accepting and listening to testimony, I think the committee would probably agree that the one thing we have learned is that we have much more to learn. The complexity of 2137 necessitates, in my opinion, the formation of two work groups. One work group that will be chaired by Representative Zauner that will deal with Section 3 of House Bill 2137. A second work group chaired by Representative Richardson will deal with Sections 4 through 9 of House Bill 2137. And we are at this point, and we do have copies of this list available. Those that I would like to have on House Bill 2137, Section 3, under Representative Zauner, will be Roger Nyquist, who is a county commissioner from Linn County, Dave Honeycutt, Randy Tucker, Dave Van Hoff, who is a representative of the governor's office, Don Schellenberg, and Bob Russell. Assigned to the work group under Representative Richardson will be Representative Ackerman, Representative Rosenbaum, Mr. Mitch Rose, Martin Taylor, Dan Cooper, and John Chandler. We will be revisiting 2137, and we need to devote our attention to the bill before us. Whether this bill should go forward as is, or whether this bill should be amended and go forward, or should it go forward. So I will look forward to the response from these work groups and hope that we will be constructive and be able to find a solution to this very complex issue. Okay, so now we're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2257. And Mr. Kelly, would you read us what that bill is all about?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2257, allows the State Parks and Recreation Department to waive or reduce application fees for ocean shore improvement permits submitted by public bodies and tribal governments if the permit sought is for projects meeting certain criteria. Current law, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, does not allow state or tribal governments to waive or reduce ocean shore improvement application fees under any circumstances. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. We have only, I believe, one person signed up to talk on 2257, so we'll ask Mike Carrier, who is the director of Oregon Parks, to come forward. And good morning, Mike. Welcome back to our committee.
Good morning. Thank you. For the record, my name is Mike Carrier, director of Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. Mr. Kelly has, I think, very clearly described the purpose of this requested amendment, and I'm here today to ask for your support for this agency bill. The department, in practice, has been waiving fees or reducing fees for Ocean Shores permits to public bodies for public projects that are considered to be in the public interest, usually projects that advance public access to the beach or habitat restoration or some other similar purpose. Our existing administrative rules, in fact, provide for waivers or reductions in fees, but a recent review of our administrative rules by legislative counsel resulted in advice from counsel that we really didn't have statutory authority to do that. So we're here before you to seek that statutory authority because we think it's clearly in the public interest for agencies to work together, to cooperate, and to do things at times when it's appropriate, such as waive or reduce fees for permits. Especially when you look at the statute and what the value of some of these permit applications could be when you add 3% of the total project cost onto the base $400 fee. Projects that, like I say, typically qualify now include sand removal from beach access, installation of public access improvements, and habitat restoration. We're simply seeking to assure that we have the authority to continue granting those waivers. We have exercised a moratorium on waivers since we've received advice from council. However, during that period, fortunately, we've not received any application from public bodies except one emergency application from the Corps of Engineers for emergency repairs to North Jetty and Coos Bay. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about this proposed bill.
Any questions of Mr. Gary?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Roosevelt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell us with what frequency you would expect these situations to arise?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, it would be infrequent. Since 1999, we've issued 5 such permits to public agencies. But the activity tends to wax and wane with the weather cycles. During El Nino patterns, such as the one we're experiencing this year, there's a lot of activity on the ocean beaches with regard to protection or repair. During the last 2 years and the intervening years between the two El Niños, there were very few permits issued, as evidenced by the fact that we only issued 5 since 1999.
Thanks.
Any other questions of Mr. Carrier? Seeing none, thank you, Mike, very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else present that would like to give public testimony in regards to House Bill 2257? The chair, seeing none, will close the public hearing on House Bill 2257. Seeing no more on our agenda, we will adjourn the committee at 9:18 a.m.
The work session.